This conference is being recorded.
Okay, welcome everybody. My name is Ula Reeves. I'm the Regional Program Director with Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. I'm pleased to welcome everyone today for SAES's May webinar. We have been having a webinar series for about a year or so now, and this month we have a special guest with us from the Union of Concerned Scientists who will be presenting about their new report entitled Burning Coal, Burning Cash. So first, just to get started, a little bit of background about the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. We have been around for a number of years. We're a leading advocate in the region for clean, responsible energy choices. We have offices throughout the region in Asheville, North Carolina, Atlanta, Georgia, Knoxville, Tennessee, and a number of staff scattered throughout our states as well. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with our work. We are partners with many folks in our states on activities, and I'll be going through a little bit more of the work that we're actually doing. Coal campaigns, energy efficiency campaigns, renewable campaigns that we work on. And for more information on Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, you can visit www.cleanenergy.org. You can also follow us on a regular basis through our blog, which is blog.cleanenergy.org. We track a number of emerging and breaking issues through our blog. We've been blogging regularly recently about the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, and try to keep everybody abreast of everything that's happening out there on a regular basis. So now I'd like to introduce today our speaker, Barb Fries, who is a staff scientist with the union, or staff attorney with the Union of Concerned Scientists. Barb is a co-author of the new report. We've been very lucky to partner with the Union of Concerned Scientists on this report release in our Southeast region. So we've had experts who traveled around with us last week and this week throughout our states to visit with allies, partners, media folks, decision makers, both at state and federal levels. And Barb came to North Carolina, was with us for a few days last week. Barb is a veteran coal fighter in Minnesota, and she is a former staff attorney with the Minnesota Attorney General's Office. She's the author of a book entitled Coal and History. So she's well-versed in coal issues. So now I'd like to go ahead and turn it over to Barb for the rest of the presentation here.
Thanks very much, Ula. And can you hear me?
Yes.
All right, great. Well, thank you, everybody, for calling in. And I'm really happy to have a chance to talk to you about this report. My co-author is Jeff Dayette, and some of you may know him from work he's done in the region and particularly on renewable energy standards. Next slide, please. One of the reasons that we wrote this report was we noticed that people were using the word coal state in a really casual way that seemed to include both states that produce a lot of coal and those that merely consume a lot of coal. And obviously there are some very big economic distinctions between those two states. And for the most part, we don't talk about that much. We talk about importing oil, but we don't talk about how much money leaves state economies from importing coal. But now seems like a really good time to talk about that, both because of all of the renewable energy and clean energy policy debates going on, but because unemployment is so high and states everywhere are looking for ways to keep more dollars in their local economies to produce jobs. So we decided to dig into the federal data to quantify just how much each state actually spends to import coal. Unfortunately, every state, or rather every coal plant, needs to report to the federal government where it gets its coal from and how much it spends. So there's a lot of data there, and we were able to dig into that and put this report together. But before I get into the import data, I'd like to give you just a little bit of background on changes in mining in this country. Next slide, please. As many of you probably know, there has been a major shift in coal mining from the east to the west over the last, starting around 1970. We are to the point now where most coal mined in the United States actually comes from west of the Mississippi, and that is primarily because of the huge strip mines in the Wyoming Powder River Basin. Meanwhile, though, most of the coal plants are still in the east, and so that means that for Wyoming to be selling so much coal, they have to penetrate well into the eastern markets, and they have been doing that with rail transport. Wyoming coal is now sold in 34 states, as far east as New York and Georgia. There's also Wyoming coal going into Alabama, Tennessee, and Mississippi. It doesn't make it much into the Carolinas or into Florida, but it is certainly a part of the reason why the region is sending its coal money not just out of state, but out of the region altogether. Next bullet, please. And next slide, then. Thank you. So we had to decide what to do with this data. There are lots of different ways you can look at a state's dependence on coal imports, and we chose six different ways to measure that dependence, and the first and I think most straightforward was simply to look at net dollars spent. We also looked at net tons imported. Then we divided it by per person, so we got spending per person. We looked at it relative to the size of the economy. We looked at total imports of coal relative to the state's power consumption. And finally, we looked at total international imports. So that gave us six different measures of coal import dependence. For each of these six measures, we identified the top 10 states. And altogether, those 10 states, because of overlaps, added up to 24 net importing states. Next slide, please. And here are the states that appeared on one or more of these six different top 10 lists. And we've color-coded them to give you an indication of how many times the states appear. And as you'll see, there's only one state that appears on all six of the top 10 lists, and that is Georgia. There are four states that appeared on five of the six top 10 lists, and that includes Alabama, Tennessee, and North Carolina. Overall, the Southeast is very well represented, indeed dominates most of our rankings. Next slide, please. So this slide we've labeled the $1 billion club. These are the 10 states that imported, the top 10 states by the amount of money they spent importing coal. I should say these are net figures. So in a few of these states where they export coal, we have subtracted that. So this ranking is based just on net. All of these states spent more than $1 billion in 2008 importing coal into their economies. So that is to say more than $1 billion left their state economies in exchange for this coal. I should say that the 11th state is South Carolina. So if we're going to really call them the $1 billion club, we need to include South Carolina. They also spent more than $1 billion in 2008. And, of course, the top two states are right up there, $2.6 billion in Georgia, followed by North Carolina at $2.3 billion. One thing I want to say about these numbers is we used 2008 because those were the latest numbers available. When the 2009 data comes out, we would expect to see these numbers going down for two reasons. One is that coal consumption went down nationwide with the recession in 2009, and coal prices, which had sort of spiked in 2008, also went down in 2009. However, in 2010, as the economy starts to expand again, we're starting to see coal prices go up already, and the Energy Information Administration, the Department of Energy, is projecting that we will see coal use increase again. So these are the 2008 numbers. They're going to go down likely in 2009 and then pop back up at least somewhat, and we don't know how much, in 2010. Next slide, please. One of the things that we were able to do was look back at some earlier data. 2008 was the first year that had data on both regulated and unregulated coal plants. So we compared 2002 to 2008, and it wasn't complete enough to make this comparison for all states, but we learned for at least three states, they saw quite dramatic increases in how much money left their economies each year to pay for these coal imports. In Georgia, imports increased 87% over those 6 years. In North Carolina, imports went up 88%. The next bullet, please. There we go. And the third bullet is Alabama. There we saw imports increase a whopping 170%, which I assume was due to less local coal mining. Generally speaking, these higher import costs, and the last bullet, please, relate mainly to the higher price of coal. The price of coal went up pretty high in 2008, but there were also more imports, largely, we think, because of existing coal units being run harder. Okay, next slide, please. As I mentioned, we looked at this in six different ways, and by the way, I'm not going to go through all six today, but I will go through three, and this is the second one. This is the one where we took their total net spending, and we divided it by their population to find out what they spent per capita. And when you look at it this way, you see the Southeast is even more dominant in the top 10 list. So the top five states are Alabama, Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Tennessee. All of these states, all the top 10, spent more than $165, with Alabama spending nearly $300 per person in 2008 to import coal from out of state. Next slide, please. And one of the reasons why we put it in per capita terms was to help us compare what the states were spending on coal imports with what they were spending on energy efficiency. And there has been other work done looking at what state energy efficiency spending has been. And I've presented here the figures for Georgia. Georgia's spending on coal in 2008 per person was $270. But its spending on energy efficiency programs per person and this is from 1 year earlier, was only 50 cents. So obviously an enormous differential here between these two levels of spending. One thing I should say is that the national average in 2007 for energy efficiency programs was over $7 per person. So whether you compare that 50 cents to the national average or you compare it to what the state spends on coal, it is obviously a very small amount of money. Next slide, please. Here is a breakdown of the states that we featured in our report. And again, you can see here the national average of spending on electricity efficiency programs was $7.36 per person. But many states are well below that, including many of the most coal import-dependent states. And some states are well above that. And as you can see here, the bars that appear in purple are the top 10 states in terms of spending on coal per capita, and you see many of them are spending less than a dollar per person on electricity efficiency. And let me just be clear here, when we're talking about this spending, these are programs that are ratepayer funded. So we're talking about spending, mainly this is going to be spending by utilities required under a state energy efficiency law using initially ratepayer money, but then helping ratepayers save money on their electric bills. Some of this money would go through public benefits funds in some states, but mostly it goes through utilities. Next slide, please. So the last measure that we used in the report, and the last one I'm going to touch on today, deals with foreign coal imports. We have 16 states all along either the East Coast or the Gulf Coast that import coal from other countries. Colombia is the main source of foreign coal, about 80%. Venezuela and Indonesia are the other two sources, our other two international sources of coal. And we try not to make too big a deal of this on the national context, because the United States remains a net exporter of coal, and in fact, coal imports only represent about 3% of our use nationwide. But those imports did triple between 1999 and 2008. They dropped down again in 2009 with the recession, but we'd be watching for those patterns to return as the economy expands. Oh, and here it is. It's 82% of the coal. This is 82% of the coal comes used in Massachusetts comes from Columbia. And so Massachusetts actually wins the prize for the single state that imports the greatest share of its coal. However, Massachusetts doesn't use very much coal, so it's all kind of relative. Next slide, please. So here are the top 10 states based on how much money they spent on coal from other countries. This one is not netted out, so we just looked at their expenditures. We did not subtract any of their own coal exports. And as you can see, Alabama tops the list at almost $500 million spent importing coal. Florida comes in next at $307 million. And the Southeast, if you including this, Mississippi and Georgia, take four out of the five top spots. Next slide, please. So for each of the states that we that made it onto one of the top 10 rankings, there were 24 net importing states. We put together a map like this to show exactly where they were getting their coal from, and or to look at it another way, where they were sending their money to. Though, as we have put on this little note here, not all of the money that's leaving the state actually ends up or necessarily ends up in the state from which the coal comes. Some of it, of course, could be diverted by coal operators that are not based in the state itself, by foreign parents or corporations based in other states. And also, I should say, this money includes transportation costs. So this is a map from Georgia. As you can see, the state gets $513 million worth of coal from Wyoming in 2008. That would then include the transportation from Wyoming. So much of that money would have gone to cover the rail costs. Georgia gets its coal from a lot of other states as well. Kentucky is actually the number one source, and Virginia ranks right up there, and it gets a bit from Columbia. Next slide, please. I put these, by the way, in order of expenditure, so we'll go through the Southeast states. Here's the slide for North Carolina. With the exception of this mysterious $1 million going to Wyoming, North Carolina gets almost all of its coal from Kentucky and West Virginia, also a bit from Virginia and a little bit from Columbia. And as I mentioned before, North Carolina and Georgia both had their coal import costs increase. The figure was 88% for Carolina, North Carolina since 2002. Next slide, please. Okay, so here's Florida, mainly getting its coal from Kentucky and West Virginia, and also a substantial amount coming from Columbia. Next slide, please. And here we are in Alabama. Alabama is really the only state with significant coal exports, by that I mean exports to other states. So what we've done for Alabama is, and this is the case for other states that do mine and sell some coal, is we've netted out the exports. So these numbers on the map are the gross figures. The headline is the net figure. So Alabama saw $1.39 billion leaving its economy in 2009 to import coal. That coal represented 79% of the coal that was burned in the state, so the rest was locally produced. But in Alabama now we see that the number one source of these imports is Colombia, nearly $500 million, not just leaving the state, but leaving the country for that coal. Wyoming and also Colorado and Utah are significant sources. So there's a lot of money being sent for coal from the West, and also still some money being spent in the more traditional mining regions of the East. Alabama, by the way, and many of you probably know this, Alabama generates far more power than its ratepayers actually buy, and we don't have the details on who they export that electricity to, but what that means is Alabama is importing lots of coal from elsewhere to generate power, some of which is likely exported somewhere else. So the people in Alabama get to experience the brunt of the environmental impacts, but are not even consuming that power. And unfortunately, the database doesn't give us exact information on that, but that is something that we note in the report. There's a lot more power being generated there than the people of Alabama are using. Next slide, please. So here is Tennessee. You'll see that Wyoming is the single largest state source of coal that they're consuming in Tennessee, but Tennessee is still getting most of its coal from the more traditional eastern mining regions. Next slide, please. Here is South Carolina and money. Oh, I hope you can still hear me.
I'm sorry, Barb. Just one moment. We seem to have
a
problem with the phone. Barb, if you can unmute yourself in just one moment. Are you there, Barb?
Okay, I've unmuted myself.
Okay, good.
Okay. So were people able to hear me up till now?
Yes, everything was fine up until now.
Great. Okay. So I'm going to keep going now with South Carolina. And as you can see from this map, South Carolina is getting its coal from the east, mainly from Kentucky, West Virginia, and some from Pennsylvania. South Carolina, like Alabama, generates more than it sells, but not quite as much more, about 25% more than it sells to its own ratepayers. So we're assuming that South Carolina is also an exporting state, though we don't know for sure if it's exporting coal power or other power generated there. Next slide, please. And finally, this is the map for Mississippi. More than 70% of the coal burned there is imported. And they're spending $457 million in 2008 importing coal, with the number one source of that coal being Colombia, followed by Colorado and Wyoming. Next slide, please. One of the reasons that we were particularly interested in the Southeast is that we have heard some in the Southeast, utilities in the Southeast, objecting to a federal renewable energy standard because of concern that it would force them to import renewable power and that that would amount to a sort of transfer of wealth. And I think that this report gives us two really good responses to that. One is that, in fact, if you're concerned about a transfer of wealth and if you're concerned about imports of energy, you really need to be looking at coal, because the region is already spending many billions of dollars every year to bring in coal. And the other answer, of course, is that the Southeast does have local renewables that they could certainly increase their use of, and that would help create local jobs, keep money in the state, and reduce the amount that's going for coal, and have lots of other environmental benefits as well. One thing we note in the report, and there are others on the line who probably know much more about this than I do, but the Southeast right now is importing coal from South America while it is exporting biomass in the form of wood pellets to Europe to be burned in the coal plants of Europe, and that's because the Europeans are trying to reduce their carbon emissions, and so they're importing biomass to do that. But that certainly indicates that the Southeast has these resources, and that's something that could be more fully exploited. Next slide, please. So I've just listed out on this slide the renewable energy potential for each of the southeastern states. And later on, we'll have a slide that shows you how to get to the report from the UCS website. But we also have, for each of these states, a fact sheet, either a one- or two-page fact sheet. And if you look at the full report, we have fact sheets for all 24 of the featured states. And in those fact sheets, we identify what is the technical potential for renewable energy use in that state compared to its 2008 power use. And we also, in the methodology, explain how we've come up with these numbers. And we're not going into a lot of detail in the report on this, but our point is mainly to indicate that there is enormous room for improvement and for expansion of using renewable energy in each of these states. Technical potential does not reflect cost, so that's more of a ceiling. But when you're only getting 1 or 1.5% or something of your power from renewable energy, and even looking at the lowest of these numbers, if you could get 41% of your power from it, that would be obviously a tremendous increase in usage and allow you to greatly reduce your coal import costs. Next slide, please. Finally, we do have a box in this report talking about a new report that's come out from the National Academy of Sciences. It's hard to issue a whole report on coal and not talk about the environment. For the most part, we don't talk much about it because we're focusing on the finances. But we do note this report that came out a few months ago. Congress asked the National Academy of Sciences to try to quantify the costs of energy production. They looked at coal emissions from coal plants, and here we're talking about sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, and particulates. And those emissions, they associated with $62 billion in costs. And these were for emissions from 1 year alone, from the year 2005. And they almost all of that $62 billion is associated with premature deaths from heart and lung disease due to inhalation of these pollutants, or what they are formed into as they go through the atmosphere. That comes out to about $156 million per plant. However, the Academy report made it clear that it depends almost entirely on SO2 emissions, and if you have a large plant with high SO2 emissions, your damages could be several times this amount. And if you have scrubbers and you're using low sulfur coal and your emissions are low, then your damages would be much less than that. And one of the things that I think is very interesting about this $62 billion figure is that it doesn't count most of the environmental and health costs that people are most familiar with. This does not count mercury contamination or other toxics from those coal plants. It does not count global warming. It does not count mining damages, whether we're talking about mountaintop removal or underground mining. It does not count coal ash disposal. So there are indeed a lot more costs than these, but even this subset of costs is pretty impressive. Next slide, please. So this is our website. It's www.ucsusa.org. And if you go there, right now we're featuring this report, and you can click on the links. You can get to the entire report. And in addition, you can get to, we have the whole report is 50 or 60 pages. We've got a four-page executive summary that you can print out. And we also have, as I mentioned, these fact sheets that are either one or two pages, depending on the state, which you can also print out and distribute. And our hope was that those fact sheets would be much easier to use and would enable folks out in each state to get the word out to those who need to know just how much money is leaving each of these states. And Ula, with that, I guess I will turn it back over to you and wait for the question and answer period to open up later.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Barb. That was excellent, and I'm sure folks will have some good questions.
for Barb in a minute. I just really quickly wanted to take a few minutes to orient folks to some of the resources that Southern Alliance for Clean Energy has to help build upon the information in UCS's new report. Barb mentioned that a number of the sentiments that come out from our utilities and decision makers often is that the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow in the Southeast. And we produced a report last year to help respond to these comments. So we created this report entitled Yes We Can, Southern Solutions for Meeting a National Renewable Energy Standard. And here are just a couple highlights about the report. We looked at the renewable energy and energy efficiency potentials from a feasible standpoint, so we did include some of the cost considerations. And so you can look into this report and get a lot more detail about what are the feasible potentials for your state's renewable energy resources. And our report ends up showing that the Southeast really does have sufficient renewable energy resources to comply with the strong federal renewable energy standard and also any renewable standards that might come down at the state level. So developing our region's renewable energy potential is not only a benefit to the region, but we can meet 30% of our energy needs in the near term. This report is available on our website at www.cleanenergy.org in the reports section. And here is just a pie chart illustrating where we can feasibly get these near-term renewable energy resources in the Southeast. We have a variety of resources. Biomass is one of the region's most important near-term options. Today, biomass and hydroelectric power are equally responsible for nearly all of the Southeast renewable energy generation, and biomass represents about two-thirds of the Southeast near-term potential for expanding renewable energy. And just really briefly, I also wanted to orient folks to some of the coal initiatives and energy efficiency and renewable initiatives that Southern Alliance for Clean Energy is working on. We continue to work to stop the development of new coal-fired power plants in the Southeast. Obviously, the construction of new coal plants will add to the out-of-state expenditures that we are already making to buy coal, as Barb went through, and we could be investing those dollars at home for clean energy and energy efficiency. Georgia is really the stronghold of new coal plant proposals. We are working to stop Power for Georgians, a conglomerate of electric municipal cooperatives in Georgia, from constructing an 800-megawatt facility called Plant Washington. They also have plans for a Plant Ben Hill that is not as far along in development, but we are keeping a very close eye on that. Dynegy's Longleaf coal plant has kind of arisen from the grave. This plant was once almost completely off the table, but now has air and water permits issued and is moving forward again. For more on that coal fight, you can connect with Georgians for Smart Energy at www.georgiansforsmartenergy.org. And SACE is still involved in litigation around Duke Energy's Cliffside coal plant. Unfortunately, this facility is over 40% complete. And while we were successful in stopping a second unit at this site, this is a brand new coal plant, an 800-megawatt facility, actually 825-megawatt facility, and is what we hope to be the last pulverized coal plant in the Southeast. There are a few bright spots in the coal fight around our region. Both the Petey and Seminole coal plants were canceled at the end of 2009. Together, they represent over 13 million tons of carbon dioxide annually that were saved from going into the atmosphere. There was a lot of advocacy and legal work involved in challenging both of those facilities. On the horizon, we do have some new opportunities around challenging coal in the Southeast. There are new retirement announcements that have been made, predominantly from Duke and Progress Energy in North Carolina. But we envision some opportunities to work with the utilities and our state officials to look for the oldest, dirtiest, least efficient facilities that are still online and get those offline so that we can replace them with cleaner alternatives. So this map just shows those retirements. In the case of Georgia's Plant Mitchell, that's actually a proposal to repower that facility with biopower. So some of these are retirements and some are repowering. We continue to work on energy efficiency around the region in Florida. We've been working with some of the utilities to defend their energy efficiency goals. We've worked with TVA and North Carolina and Georgia with the resource planning processes to include energy efficiency. There are some new energy efficiency programs. Duke Energy has a Save a Watt program, so we're involved in working with the advisory collaborative to implement the Save a Watt program. And we're working on some new innovative programs around energy recycling, which is also called combined heat and power, and we're predominantly doing that in Carolinas, but if folks would like any more information on that, it's a new emerging technology, a great way for us predominantly in commercial building situations to be able to recycle any waste heat. And a few other campaigns that Southern Alliance for Clean Energy is working on. Around the region, we're working on biomass. We're working to promote sustainability parameters in federal legislation that defines biomass. And we are evaluating plant proposals based on various criteria, including resource availability, environmental impacts, and need on biomass. It's a very important issue for us to make sure that any biomass, biopower facilities being considered are done so with the utmost consideration for sustainability. We have led the Regional Wind Energy Initiative as part of the Department of Energy wind efforts in Tennessee and Kentucky, and we're coordinating a Department of Energy grant aimed at building market acceptance for wind energy in Georgia and South Carolina, predominantly looking at offshore wind. And we've also been tracking and participating in a number of initiatives to promote solar, and we are producing our own waste grease biofuel in Tennessee. So those are just a few points of reference for folks in terms of what Southern Alliance for Clean Energy is working on that relates back to the information that Barb presented in the Union of Concerned Scientists new report. So now we'll open it up to questions, and I'll turn it back to Courtney to tell us which questions have come in, and Barb and I can answer them accordingly, or we have some other staff on the line as well who can answer more detailed questions. Okay, do we have some questions?
Yes, we do. Our first question is from Paul, and it's for Barb. With coal being so expensive in the West versus Eastern coal, why are more utilities not using the lower cost fuel source, specifically Florida utilities?
Well, coal per ton is much less expensive in the West and more expensive in the East. But I think that leads to the same question of why there's so much being used. Part of it, of course, is that once you've built a coal plant, you're sort of locked into that, and you're not likely to want to stop using it. And the other is that the cheapest thing that you can do is invest in energy efficiency, which is great for consumers, great for the environment, great for economic development in the state, but not so great for the utilities themselves because it reduces their income. So unless you pass, unless you are able to, through energy policies, change how your utilities are compensated, or unless you simply require them to do it with a policy, you're not going to see them really investing in energy efficiency. There's also, I think, a kind of cultural reluctance to invest in new power sources for every utility anywhere in the country, and I think this applies both to investor-owned utilities and publicly-owned utilities. They know coal plants, and they know how to run them. And so we find that even when there are other economic options that make much more sense, they tend to want to hang on to those old coal plants and, in fact, build new ones when they can.
That's great. Paul also wanted to know, he saw in the FERC 423 data that Tampa Electric imported coal from a small environmentally sensitive Norwegian island north of the Arctic Circle. Is there anything going on with that?
Wow. Well, I just want to say that was it. Paul has really dug into this database. I have not seen that, and I'll go back and ask Jeff about it. I think that's the first I've heard, and it's really interesting. I suspect it's just a tiny amount, but I'd still love to know more about it.
And then also from Paul, and this I think is more about biomass. He is looking to find out more information about wood pellet economics. It currently shows prices about $100 a ton, well above eastern coal.
I think John Bonitz is on the line, so maybe I will defer this question to him.
Yeah, that would be good. John, are you available? You can hit *6 to unmute yourself, John.
Okay, hi. Can you now hear me?
Yep.
Great. Yes, Paul, thanks for that question. I was looking through some of the resources I have. I'm not privy to some of the proprietary databases of actual pellet prices, but from what I have read in articles, I was not able to lay hands on them at the moment, but it is definitely a range between $175 a ton all the way up to $275 a ton for wood pellets. Now, those higher prices are what we're seeing for pellets packaged in 40, 50-pound bags for domestic market here in the U.S. The export market is going to tend to be at the lower range, but it's still, yes, you're right, it's still much higher than coal prices. And the reason for that is that the Europeans have pushed up demand because they are attempting compliance with the Kyoto Protocol, and so they're attempting to reduce their carbon emissions by co-firing their coal plants with some wood pellets from largely the southeastern United States.
Thank you, John. This is a question for Ulla, and William wants to know, how has the North Carolina press picked up on the report? Have others used the data?
We've had some response from the North Carolina press, not actually as much as we had hoped for. I think the Charlotte Business Journal reported on it. The North Carolina Public Radio reported on it. We had an opportunity to meet with a couple of editorial boards when Barb was in town visiting with us. And so we're hoping that we will get some editorials from the Asheville Citizen-Times, the Winston-Salem Journal, and the Greensboro paper as well. We also have an investigative reporter, Sue Sturgis, with Facing South, who is interested, and we may be able to do some follow-up media work with her on this report. So we hope to continue to get the data and information from this report, continue to get it out into the media world. And if anybody on this webinar would like to work with us to put out a letter to the editor in their paper about this report, we would love to work with you on that so that we can get even more attention on it.
This next question is from William. Was waste-to-energy incinerators considered in the renewable technical potential? Is there a SACE UCS position on this?
I can tell you that the landfill gas was, but I don't believe any waste-to-energy was included. And landfill gas, I believe, was a pretty small part of it for almost all of the states. And I honestly don't know that UCS has a position on it, except to say that it shouldn't be something that gets any credit under a renewable energy standard.
Okay.
Yeah, and as for the inclusion of that in the Yes We Can report, I'd be happy to follow up and double check the methodology there, and just I'm pretty sure that ours wasn't either. It didn't include it in Yes We Can, but there are some different definitions of waste to energy. The inclusion of methane, say from hog farms, as a renewable source, very well may have been included, in all likelihood probably was included. And I don't know, John Bonas, if you have anything else to add there.
Sure, yeah, Ula, I can confirm conclusively that we did not incorporate municipal solid waste or RDF, refuse-derived fuel, in Southern Solutions. So basically, that means our director of research concluded that it's not necessary to meet a 25% renewable electricity standard for most southeastern states. If we did want to go back to the pie chart, Ula, that you included, we could see the precise types of biomass that are depicted and that we studied and quantified. And as Barb mentioned, it does include landfill methane. It also does include some methane from livestock manure. But garbage burning is not a part of our report.
Okay. We have another question from Paul. And the question is if biofuel pellets are such good business, why did Dixie Pellet, 500,000 tons a year, go bankrupt after just 2 years of operation?
That's a great question. I'm going to guess nobody else on the call knows much more about it than I do, but I can say that from what I've gathered from reports, I think the project was poorly financed at the get-go and did not have sufficient cash reserves basically to start up. I've also read something that led me to believe there may have been some controversy outside of that, perhaps just bad business or on top of bad planning. But I don't want to say that because I don't know the folks who were involved with that project. I do gather that these pellet projects are successful largely for the most part, and we will probably see more of them unless we craft policy that indicates it is preferable to use that energy source here domestically to offset our own pollution emissions and reduce emissions of mercury and particulates and sulfur dioxide and nitrous oxide associated with coal. It does seem kind of silly, I will say, that we're exporting wood pellet renewable energy while importing coal to our region.
And if I could just add, I think obviously one of the things to keep in mind is that right now there is not a renewable energy standard in most of the Southeast, and if such a standard were adopted at the state level or at the federal level, I think that would change the economic outlook for these types of facilities. I don't know anything about Dixie Pellet, but as far as their business prospects are concerned, they're certainly hampered by a lack of applicable renewable energy policies.
Well, thank you very much. I will be now opening the lines for any additional questions. Please hold. The line is now open.
I have a question. This is Bobby. Where was that plant, that pellet plant, that went bankrupt? Yes.
If folks can hit *6 on their personal line, we can keep the background noise to a minimum, and then you can hit *6 to open the line and answer a question.
I believe it was Ms. Bobby McClendon who asked about the state where Dixie Pellets recently went bankrupt, and I think that was in Selma, Alabama.
Because I think one is in operation in Baxley, Georgia, and Madison, Florida, and I think they're doing real well.
Yes, sir, and there's a new one that started up in North Georgia. I think it's near Charleston. That's a very large, I think it's bragged that it's the largest pellet plant in the world, and it's a German conglomerate. We do anticipate more of these pellet plants are going to be proposed and possibly built. Again, if we craft either state-level or national renewable electricity standards, and even better, a national carbon law, we can regulate some of that harvest and use of that material. Otherwise, it's just going to happen, and it's going to be exported to countries that are already in compliance with their own carbon laws.
Do we have any other questions out there?
This is Paul Messerschmidt. I have a question, please.
Okay. Go ahead, Paul.
Back to my earlier question about Eastern coal versus Western coal. Actually, in analyzing the numbers, I mean, Wyoming coal is currently priced about $10 a ton, whereas the coal that, at least in Florida and most of the other eastern states, are purchasing is about $60 per ton. I accept the fact that there's a heat rate difference and there's a transportation difference, but a question would be, if they just substituted Western coal for Eastern coal, we could reduce Florida's coal expenses by $500 million, which then could potentially be turned around and used for energy efficiency. And in fact, Progress Energy had a fuel case hearing back in 2007 where the question as to whether they were paying too much for coal became an issue. And I'm just curious, why are we using Eastern coal at $60 a ton when I can buy it from Wyoming for $10?
Well, my understanding is the transportation costs become a very significant concern when you're getting that far east. Not done a breakdown.
It's only $20.
$20 a ton to bring it in to where?
$20 a ton. You can go to all kinds of EPA and DOE websites on that. And obviously Alabama's doing it, so I don't understand why Florida can't do it. I mean, I'm not supporting coal. I'm just saying, why am I spending $1.6 billion when I could be spending $800 million?
I think that's a question for your utilities, then. I think it's an interesting question. Obviously, that wasn't exactly at the point of our report, rather to try to get folks to stop importing coal altogether and spend it on local renewables and energy efficiency. But whether they could have gotten a better deal on coal that has lower sulfur and doesn't remove mountains by shifting to Western coal over Eastern, you know, I think that's an interesting question, and we have not looked at that in this report.
I'm going to suggest it might be long-term contracts that are causing those purchases to continue past what might appear to be uneconomical.
Because the 423 data doesn't indicate that they've got long-term coal contracts. And, in fact, interestingly enough, Tampa Electric, which owns four coal mines in the eastern part of the United States, doesn't use any of their own coal for their generating plants. They buy it, as you say, from the east. They buy it from Columbia. And, yes, if you look at the 423 data, there's environmentally sensitive island north of the Arctic Circle in Norway. Apparently, it's got very high quality coal, but it's got to be either awful cheap or awful special.
Paul,
yeah,
that's very interesting information. I'm going to suggest that you share some of this information with Sue Sturgis, the investigative reporter with the Institute for Southern Studies, and I'll get your email address from Courtney based on your registration and connect you to.
Happy to share.
Okay, are there any additional questions? We're going to wrap up here in just a minute.
May I make a comment?
Go ahead.
This is Bobby, and this was an excellent presentation. And I continue to still yet learn more about what we're dealing with. And I want to thank Barb and Ula and everybody, John Bonnet, and everybody for the outstanding job they did, and we need to keep this sort of thing up, and maybe it'll sink through one day to the people that matter.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bobby. Yeah. Okay. Without further ado, we will adjourn this webinar. Thank you all very much for taking time out of your day to join us for this. And again, please visit the websites that we've given for more information, and please use the UCS data and the Yes We Can Southern Solutions data to help in all of the advocacy work that you do in your communities and organizations to help us make a difference out there.
Thank you for having me.
Thank
allowing
you.
Me to be on.
Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye. Thanks, everybody.
Goodbye.